I am Platt on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Conrad Black joins me again. We'll touch on current affairs such as the presidential contest in the United States, the dominance of Donald Trump in the Republican primary process, and what's happening in the Democratic Party with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. But with Conrad's indulgence, we'll also talk about his 13-year-old book, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Champion of Freedom, one of the better books on FDR. I reread the book last year prior to making a trip to Hyde Park, New York, the site of Roosevelt's presidential library and birthplace. Perhaps there are lessons in the lives of Franklin and Eleanor useful as we see what's happening in America today. Conrad Black's website is at conradmblack.com. You can read him regularly at the National Post and National Review. He is a television personality on the Zoomer program, a financier, and a former newspaper proprietor, among other things. His previous books include two memoirs, biographies of Maurice Duplessis and Richard Nixon, as well as histories of the United States and Canada, Flight of the Eagle, and Rise to Greatness. Please welcome back to the Platt Online program in Toronto today, Conrad Black. Lord Black, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. So before we get into the Roosevelts, which I want to talk to you about, some contemporary things. The election in the United States, I mean, you're friends with Donald Trump. You've known him for a long time. Did you ever think that he'd run for president?
No, he considered it before. I knew that, and I thought that when he decided not to do it then, he would not change his mind. But he does a good deal of polling in general. I mean, some private sector people for their own interest do that. Lord Ashcroft does more polling than anyone else in the UK, and he's not running for anything. But he picked up, as I heard Marco Rubio say as he bowed out of the race the other night, nobody else did. The extent to which popular opinion, irrespective of party, felt that the people, the officials of government in general, federal government, were dishonest, and that they were over-dominated by special interests, and that the system was largely corrupt and incompetent. And he recognized that a complete outsider could have a powerful appeal, and that's what's happened.
Well, what about the things that you're hearing in the news now? I mean, there are, you know, a lot of reservations about him, you know, suggesting or at least condoning violence. Some people think he's a racist or at the very least indifferent to those who are avowed racists who support him. In your experience with him, is he an extremist?
No, I have to say I am extremely irritated by that. I have no objection to people not liking Donald's style. I don't like it particularly myself as a public person. I mean, when he, in person, he couldn't be more gracious and agreeable and a delightful man to have dinner with. But some of this blustering and bombast and so on is very annoying. That I understand. But he has an absolutely unblemished record as an equal opportunity employer, and he did disavow David Dukes and the Klan when he was first asked about it. He wasn't aware of the context. And he's certainly not a racist. I mean, he has backed off the comment about no Muslims being entering the country, and he's backed off the comment, or at least clarified it, about the Mexicans who've entered illegally. I mean, the fact is, over 11 million people have entered that country illegally, and the entire political class just ignored it. They finally came up with some Band-Aid remedies and have called it comprehensive immigration reform. Well, I accept that Donald has spoken in an Archie Bunker way, but he was pitching to Archie Bunker people. Now that his base is broadened substantially, and the field is narrowed, so he's regularly pulling over 40% of the vote, and the Economist poll last week showed him at over 50% support among Republicans. He's cleaned up the message quite a bit, but he is absolutely not a racist. And the violence thing, I mean, the fact is, these left-wing groups, MoveOn.org and whatever that African-American group calls itself, have disrupted his meetings and have provoked some violence, and he has defended his people. But he is, this attempt to label him as a fascist taking the first step towards the incitement of street bullies and so on is absolutely He's nothing of a kind. He does not want to alter the democratic system in the slightest degree, and I don't think there's a racially prejudiced bone in his body.
Now, some of your colleagues at National Review don't like him and have come out against him.
Yeah, well, I don't agree with them, and I've written in that magazine that I don't agree with them. They're still friends of mine, but I think they're making fools of themselves. Like Rich Lowry made a fool of himself on television the other night with Megyn Kelly speculating on whether when the Trump Organization denied accreditation for a member of the press to come to Donald's remarks on at the end of the Tuesday evening when the primaries were held in the Mar-a-Lago club, which he owns, that this constituted an infringement of the First Amendment rights of free speech. I mean, a man can keep a single member of the press out of a club that he owns after that person, 2 days after he's written a very nasty hit piece on his campaign manager. That isn't the impairing the rights of the press. If he attempted to stop this person from writing the blog he does, that would be impairing the rights of the press. But I think this is nonsense. And I think Rich and John Podhoretz and Bill Kristol and the rest of them are friends of mine, and they're very intelligent men, and they're quite elegant writers most of the time. But I think they're drinking their own bathwater. Of course Donald isn't such a profound conservative. No, he isn't. He isn't all that conservative, which is one of the reasons that he's probably going to win. I mean, the public is not ready to go beyond the 30-yard lines, and Donald, in policy terms, is inside the 30-yard lines. He's just been, you know, he's just been represented as something other than that because of an over-focusing on comments and immigration, but they, and to some degree the trade deals, but he is pitching initially to people who see millions of people entering the country illegally and taking or threatening their jobs, and trade deals that appear to export jobs and import unemployment. And unfortunately, there's some truth to that perception. But he's the only candidate, apart from Sanders, who advocates, I mean, Hillary Clinton would claim she does, but she's on the line, but he certainly is the only Republican who advocates universal medical care as much as possible in the private sector. And he is the only candidate, apart from Sanders, who's acknowledged that the United States is largely to blame for this horrible humanitarian disaster in the Middle East. And he's not in favor of any breaks for the rich, even though he's one of them himself. And he is, in fact, in policy terms, a moderate, and that's what the conservative intellectuals don't like. They think it's their turn for a real red-blooded conservative. Well, they're not going to get them. I mean, they've got Cruz, but Cruz's idea of conservatism, apart from his admirable proposal to abolish the IRS, is just throwing red meat at the Bible-thumping, gun-toting corncobbers. That isn't conservatism.
So when you look at where the United States is today, I mean, we've talked in the past about the history of the United States, I mean, in the context of one of your previous books, Flight of the Eagle. When you look at the rise of Sanders and now Trump on the other side of the political aisle, if you will, what's happening to America?
Well, it's had 20 years of bad government, and that happens to countries sometimes, and the results are a drastic diminution in its prestige in the world and a serious diminution of its economic health. And in a democracy, when that happens, you get experimentation. In the 30s, we had Huey Long and Father Coughlin and Francis Townsend and others bidding unsuccessfully for the support of the broad electorate of the country, and they had a very skillful president, whom I gather we're about to talk about, Franklin D. Roosevelt, who mm-hmm. kept the extremists at bay and stole their thunder when he needed to. And here we've had sharp divisions within both parties, but I think the system will work and produce an administration that will address many of the concerns of the country. But I think future historians will be astounded that the political class of recent years actually thought that the 900-pound gorilla of 11 million illegal immigrants sitting in the country, festering and then asserting rights that they did not naturally possess, was allowed to just fester as a problem as long as it has without anyone really raising it. And one way or another, I think what we're going to get is the administration, next administration, whoever's ahead of it, making a much more serious effort to get to grips with the issues that disturb the country. I mean, 60% of American households don't have $1,000 in cash or the ability to lay hands on it. And the middle class is stagnant in income and buying power over 15 years. Keep in mind, Joe, the United States is not a country like Italy or France even, or Latin America, for example, where the people are habituated to the government being incompetent, corrupt, and essentially a nuisance. Americans don't particularly like government, but they do not expect their governments to embarrass the country and the world and be the authors of actual backward movement in the economic status and general serenity of mind of the citizens, and that has happened. The combination of the last part of the Clinton administration and practically all of the George W. Bush and Obama administrations has been to discourage, disappoint, and outrage, and in many cases frighten Americans. And the system responds to that as it should in a democracy. I mean, I think it is a sign of American political strength, at least the strength of the system and the judgment of the public, that they haven't gone farther afield than Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. I mean, Bernie Sanders is pretty wingy, but you know he's a nonviolent person, and Donald Trump is actually a moderate politically.
But by the way, you mentioned Father Coughlin. Wasn't he Canadian?
He was.
Yeah, I think I read that in your book.
He was originally. His church was in Detroit. It had a huge radio audience.
Yeah. So to Franklin Roosevelt, in this book that you wrote 13 years ago, or was published 13 years ago, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Champion of Freedom. When that came out, that book sold well and was well reviewed, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. What compelled you to write about Roosevelt? I mean, was there a lifelong interest on your part?
I was interested in him. My first recollections of adult conversations and my first reading of picture books about recent history and even news stories were all about people who'd been leading figures in World War II. Roosevelt, of course, died when I was a baby, but the many others, Mr. Churchill, General Eisenhower, and others were still very active for a long time. And so I was interested in him, and I read a lot about him, and I came to the conclusion that he had been effectively misunderstood, that there was a division between his admirers who were so idolatrous, the Arthur Schlesingers and Doris Kearns Goodwins and others, and I knew Arthur well. There's no disparagement of him. He was a fine historian and a very nice man. But they were convinced that Roosevelt was, as he projected himself as, a kindly and rather guileless country squire, just full of goodwill, an intelligent man, but a straightforward meliorist, just a person, I'm trying to think of the word for it, a reformer, a traditional mm-hmm. progressive reformer, just wanted to make things better and improve things for everybody, but not a particularly scheming or crafty person. And his opponents portrayed him as a socialist and a gullible person in international affairs. He was duped by Stalin and bungled the peace, having, I think everyone conceded, done a good job as a war leader. And the more I read into these views, the more convinced I was that the true Roosevelt is not really being portrayed. And the true Roosevelt was certainly a seeker of objectively desirable goals. But he was Arthur Schlesinger was right when he said he wasn't a Machiavelli, because he made Machiavelli seem like a Sunday school teacher. He was an extremely crafty and devious politician, but almost invariably for good causes. And the theory that he was outwitted by Stalin is nonsense. The fact is he was chiefly responsible for creating the situation by which the Russians took 95% of the casualties as between the big three of Soviet Union, United States, and British Commonwealth. 95% of the casualties in subduing the Germans, but the West, the democratic West, ended up with Germany, France, Italy, and Japan solidly in the Western camp as ultimately flourishing democratic allies. And the Soviet Union, for their trouble, got a tenuous hold on, I mean, it was a hard thing for the people involved in the what used to be called the satellite countries in Eastern Europe, but they were very second-rate strategic assets compared to Germany, France, Italy, and Japan, four of the most important countries in the world. And in the summer of 1940, all four of those countries were in the hands of enemies of the West, undemocratic enemies of the West. And at the end of 1945, they were all in the hands of the West. And the Russians paid most of the bill in terms of destruction of their country. That certainly was inevitable geographically. But the casualties they took, in order to get to Berlin, Stalin took casualties that no Western country could have accepted.
Well, one of the more interesting places that I went to in Hyde Park was Valkill, which was, I guess, Eleanor's own home that he built for her. And she lived, I guess, part of the time till the end of her life there. What was her own role in the rise of Franklin? And do you think she was one of the more effective first ladies?
Very effective in certain ways, but the presentation of her as a virtual co-president is nonsense. It was a dysfunctional marriage, and their relations were extremely attenuated at times. That's one of the reasons she moved out of their house. And when in New York City, she lived down in Washington Square. Franklin didn't set foot in her home in New York until the famous automobile tour he took in New York City in the closing weeks of the 1944 election. But she was a wonderful woman in some ways, and she was absolutely invaluable in helping him through his illness. Indispensable even in mundane physical tasks at the onset of it, and certainly in encouraging him to overcome it. And as the president's wife, she was extremely valuable in getting around and getting an inside look at things in a way that he couldn't do. Not so much because of his illness, but the president simply can't do his job and travel around as much as she did at times, reporting on conditions. And she did this in the war, too, and visited the people in the armed forces all around, even in active theaters, and acted on complaints. I mean, she, for instance, is credited by General Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, who had the magnificent title of Chairman of the Combined Allied Military Chiefs, which put him technically at the head of 25 million soldiers, sailors, and aviators. And she toured around and came back to him and said, the soldiers need thicker socks. They're catching colds in terrible numbers because the socks issued to them don't protect them against British weather. This is when they were waiting to invade Europe from Britain, and so a new issue was made, and it reduced the incidence of colds drastically. It sounds not very interesting, but this meant a great deal to millions of men, and she was a very compassionate, reforming person, but a difficult wife, and he was no prize as a husband either.
So what are the lessons for these folks running for the presidency today in terms of what they might heed from the life of FDR?
Yes, you can learn a great deal from him, not because he was ever very revealing of what he was going to do, and I've gone, as you would expect, pretty thoroughly through his papers, and they don't tell you much about him because he was very mysterious. He had this wonderful personality and this overpowering charm, but he almost never revealed what he was going to do. As Eleanor said, after being married to him for 40 years, no one knows him and no one knows anything about him. And I don't know him. But in terms of political tactics, he certainly wrote the playbook for everybody. There's never been a rival to him in political success in a major Democratic country. To have been elected four times in a row as president and hold control of both houses of the Congress all through that time is an astounding achievement. And he had various methods of doing it. No one knows how it is that he knew the people, because he had such a prosperous and patrician background, and yet they loved him. And when the votes came in from the working class districts of the great cities of the United States, they came in a thundering tidal wave for him, four elections in a row. But also in human character, it's an astonishing thing when you see how severely handicapped he was. He had no use of his legs at all, he disguised this by being surrounded by a phalanx of aides and moving forward, swinging his legs straight from the hip, swinging them one at a time while standing on the other and supporting himself with one hand on the upper arm of a colleague, a Secret Service person, or one of his sons, mm-hmm. and the other with a cane in his hand. As he said himself, after you've spent a whole year trying to move one toe, nothing is difficult. And he was an extremely courageous man in the way he overcame that handicap. Now, today, I don't think an incapacity of that kind would be politically negative. I think people would tend to respect it, or at least not take it into account in how they would vote. But in those days, it was thought that if the public knew how serious his condition was, they would not have voted for him.
And we've seen in recent years this revival of interest in the Roosevelts. There was that movie that I know you didn't like, Hyde Park on Hudson, with Bill Murray.
I liked it in some ways, but the idea that the president of the U.S. was conducting simultaneous affairs with practically every female around him, and was doing so literally under the gaze of the King of England in the one weekend he spent in that house, is preposterous. But there were some. I thought the characterizations were good. I thought Bill Murray did well as FDR. I thought all of the players played the roles well, except the person who played the Queen Mother, as we remember, then the Queen, didn't convey the charm of the person, or indeed her fine appearance either.
Did you like the Ken Burns miniseries?
I thought it was Ken Burns. I think is always very good, and I did like it. I thought it. It could have gone further in, if just another couple of minutes of direct analysis of what Roosevelt accomplished, particularly in the strategic area, would have made clearer to people why he was so successful and was elected as he was again and again. But I did, and I thought. I thought it portrayed quite fairly the relationship he had with his wife, which was in some respects splendidly collaborative, but in others very, very difficult.
The sale of your home was in the news recently, and the only thing that, that interested me as I saw the photographs online was the size of your library. And I was wondering, how many books do you own?
25,000, approximately.
Yeah. And
some of them are in England, though.
Yeah, and so what sort of shopper are you for books? I mean, do you go to used bookstores like
the rest of us? They send me catalogs all the time. I haven't been as big a buyer the last few years as I was for about 20 years before that, but I always keep an eye out for them. I have some interesting historic books, but for the most part, I just buy books on subjects I like, and I'm not necessarily chasing interesting bindings. I mean, the fact is, it's usually more easy to read a modern book because the printing is clearer.
Mm-hmm. And you don't read on an e-reader, or do you?
Not very much. My wife does, and she tells me I should. And I think it's probably, if you're reading in bed or something, it's probably easier than to hold a book, especially if it's a big book. But I like being able to put a line in the margin or something like that. And now they say, the advocates of Kindle and so on say you can do that, but I've not figured out how to do it.
But there's nothing like holding a book, is there?
No. I just want to make the point that I sold the house, but I'm still here, and I'll stay here indefinitely, and probably as long as I'm around, and I have an option to buy it back, so I'm not going anywhere.
Does it surprise you that people were interested in that?
In the house?
You know, that they were interested in writing about what was happening with the house?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, houses are sold or leased all the time. I mean, I accept it's not like every house, but I was, although I mean, I didn't see it all, but I'm told that the stories were all, there was nothing offensive in the stories. It was just curiosity. I think it's, by today's standards, an old-fashioned house. I mean, it isn't in its construction or the electrical system or the air control system. Those are very modern. But the configuration of it, I mean, houses don't have big libraries in them, and they often don't have separate dining rooms. And the way houses are configured has changed a bit from what I did here.
Well, when you buy books, by the way, you'll indulge me, do you sign the fly leaf?
No, what I'm going to do is get a... Incidentally, I have right beside me as we're speaking the only book in the world that was signed by both Roosevelt and Churchill. Unfortunately, it just has their autographs, nothing else, but it's still interesting for that. But I do not, and I have a lot of Roosevelt's books, and he signed all of his, but what I'm going to do is get a book plate and put them in, because, I have a great many antique books, and I have some very interesting book plates in them, and for example, the imprimatur of Napoleon himself in one.
Really?
Actually, in several. And I should do that, and I don't. My father used to do it, and I have a number of his books here.
Yeah, I find that book owners are divided as to whether to do. I mean, I do it because I own the book, so I'd like, you know. But I also find it fun when I go to used bookstores and I buy books, and I see people who've owned it previously, and I add my name too, because I figure one day I won't own it, and it'll go on to someone else.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's a good point. I was just picked out of a shelf the other day in a room I happened to be in for other reasons, of a book that whose title was timely to something I was doing, and I noted that it was signed by an Englishman in 1878 or something. It's still in very good condition, quite readable.
I understand that you've got a book coming out in the fall.
Yeah, but it's one of these. It's not a real book like others I've done, in the sense that it's a collection of columns and essays that I've written. So I don't have to do much new composition for it. It's just a selection of them and a few comments on some of them, and putting them in different sections according to subject. That's all. It's not a big book like my History of Canada or something.
Yeah. Well, I hope you'll come on the program and talk about that when it's out.
Always a pleasure to speak with you, Joe.
Thanks for this, Conrad. I can't think of a better way to spend my Friday morning, especially my birthday, talking to you. And
very many happy returns. Hope you have a nice celebration later in the day.
I'm going to go buy books today. That's my plan.
Good for you.
Thanks, Conrad.
Thank you.
Conrad Black joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.